Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
My name's Catherine Carr, and this is season two of Relatively, the podcast all about potentially the longest relationships of your life.
I think when we're not fighting, it's so nice. I mean, it makes it sound like we fight all the time.
We do.
I'll be bringing siblings together to talk about the connections they have as adults, as well as what it was like growing up together.
Our mother brought discipline and a kind of role-modelled diligence and conscientiousness. And our dad, who has all those qualities, but is more anarchic.
This week, we're talking to Dr. Chris and Dr. Zand, the Van Tulleken twins.
He created a huge amount of moment-to-moment fun, blowing stuff up, dyeing our food different colours. Every breakfast was an experiment.
But I'll also talk to them separately to get a more private take on the relationship.
Zand is the funny twin, and I'm the straight boring twin.
He has a get up and go that is very, very unusual. He is entirely responsible for getting both of us into medical school.
Brothers and sisters are never straightforward. Chris and Zand are both 42. Neither of them are sure which is the oldest. The twins present Operation Ouch on CBBC, but their latest project is a podcast all about food and weight. Explosive subjects for siblings. We talk about fighting, binge eating, and a near-death experience. But Chris starts the story in third form at school.
I think Mum and Dad did a really smart thing. I've never asked them about how they reached this conclusion. We always went to the same school, but we were always in different classes. And there's a funny thing that Zand and I have where anyone who is my friend, you may experience this in a few minutes. Anyone who is my friend or who I have a relationship with can immediately just pick up with Zand where they left off with me. You'll feel like you know him because, you know, you and I've got on for the last, 20 minutes, whatever.
Yeah, that's definitely true that if people have met Chris, then I relax and I think, well, you've effectively already met me and it doesn't, I can't make a good impression or a bad impression. If they like Chris, they'll like me. If they didn't like Chris, there's no hope. And so I don't worry about it.
He would go and make friends in his 3M he was in, and I was in 3LN. And I had my friend Tim Millington, who's still one of my best friends in 3LN. And Tim became friends with Zand. And then Zand had his friends in 3M, and they became my friends. So it amplified the friends whilst allowing us to be our own people. But we wanted to be together, and we were very lucky we got to go to medical school together, I think largely because one of the profs there was kind of interested in twins and genes. We asked him later, he said, no, I really just let you in because I wanted to see what would happen.
So I would say I am so lucky to have a twin brother, and I always think what my life would be like if I didn't have Chris, and I think I would be kind of utterly unfulfilled and doing something I hate. And I would say Chris is he has a get up and go that is very, very unusual. And when we were kids, he stole the maps from the summer camp that we used to go to. I think they were old maps. I don't think it was a bad theft, but he wasn't meant to take them. Our parents are Canadian. And so we were on going to summer camp in Canada, and he brought them back to England and planned a whole canoe trip when we were 16 in Northern Canada. This bit of the world he'd never been to before. And just always wanted, when I was a junior doctor, he would try and get me to come with him to the Arctic and do these expeditions. And he has always dragged me along on his mad adventures. And without him, I think I would be doing something very... I wouldn't have gone to medical school. I mean, he got me into medical school.
Is that right? He said that the guy who sort of let you in was curious about having some twins in his class. That's his story.
No, what happened was Chris said we should do medicine, and I had been sort of gormlessly staring out the window for my entire childhood and thought that medicine sounded as good as anything. And certainly when I was a kid, you know, when you're 13, if you say to an adult, I wanted to be the lead singer in Guns N' Roses, when people ask me what I wanted to do. And so if you start saying, I want to be a doctor, people are like, oh, that's great. Come and do some work experience at my surgery. Like, people sort of take you under their wing.
And of course, when you are, yeah, I think we were 14 or 15, you say, I think I'll be a doctor. Everyone gets behind you and pushes, you know?
Seriously, it's the most glorious thing you can say at a family Christmas, you know, isn't it?
Exactly. And of course, the reality of having two sons who are doctors is it's just, you don't really see them very much. And, you know, it's not a very glamorous career. And then what was nice is we cooperated. So when it came to our interviews and things, Zahn and I just spent weeks interviewing each other. So I remember coming out of the interviews, every interview we had for medical school, and just I'd already practiced the questions with him. And that was really an amazing leg up.
Mm.
And so it was immediately apparent this was a good idea. And then Chris just sat me down and interviewed me for months before our interviews. So when I got asked about the BSE crisis, and I had literally given Chris a 10-minute answer a couple of weeks before, having read articles about it, because he said it might come up. I mean, he's entirely responsible for getting both of us into medical school.
That's so funny, because he tells a very kind of even-handed version of that story, that you interviewed each other, and so he was prepared because you had helped him be prepared.
Well, I did help, but he was the driving force. But no, everything he's told you is lies.
When I was talking to Zant, he told a very sweet story about how you provide a lot of the get up and go in the energy, Chris, and how you stole, although he didn't think it was too naughty, some old maps from a camp in Canada and used it to plan an expedition. Do you remember that?
I'd forgotten I took the maps. I think the maps were going to be thrown away. I mean, I want to kind of reinvent. I'm often the one who says we should go and do a thing, but Zahn's the one who enables it to happen. Okay, at the moment, we're trying to do a live kids show on stage, and I'm like, we should definitely do this and we should write it, and we are writing it. It'll be in the West End. But I can't do it, right? I'm not funny or enormously creative, nor very gifted on stage. Whereas Zahn'd, if I say, look, can you sort of write the show about this? Zahn will write the song, do the dance, make this whole show happen. But I'll have to be like, Zahn, the show is starting on Tuesday. It's now Monday evening. We haven't rehearsed. Can we please, you know?
All, and he's like, yeah, but we'll get there eventually.
So there is some teamwork, but there's a lot of like, how dare you, you know, I've done more, you know, there's a bit of that, but... Yeah. So I'm like I'm the starter and Zahn's the finisher, maybe?
Someone, it has to be the originator, the generator, and someone's the reactor. I think that's in all good creative teams, right? So tell me a little bit about being a twin. Obviously, you've never not been a twin, but what's it like for you being a twin?
There are some really lovely things about being a twin, but the bad things are all tangled up with the good things. People think that Zahn and I are the same person, and that can be fun. But I sometimes only feel like I'm half there if he's not around. I don't think anyone who hasn't met him really knows me. And he's usually the better version of me.
Really?
Yeah, Zand, anyone who watches the children's show we do on Operation Ouch knows that Zand is the funny twin and I'm the straight, boring twin. And that's true in real life. I'm quite a shy, inhibited, anxious person who is deeply concerned with what the world around me thinks of me. And Zand is a very uninhibited, hilarious, confident, funny person who can give a 10-minute speech off the cuff and dance on a table. And I watch Zand doing these things and sort of marvel. But I also feel like, oh, I could do that too, although I never will.
I was the first twin out, which in some countries would make me the younger one, but in the UK makes me 7 minutes older than Chris.
It would make you the younger one?
In Holland, the tradition is that the one who's out first was made last, as if it's some sort of factory assembly process up there. And so in Holland, all the, you know, inheritance stuff would be reversed. Several people have told me that. I've never formally fact-checked it, so forgive me if I'm wrong, but I've always been told that there are countries where the logic is different.
Zand is older. He's 7 minutes older, so he came out first. I don't know why I found that hard.
And so who is protective of who then in that dynamic? Is anyone?
That's an amazing question. I'm dependent on Zand, but I protect him. Which is much more to do with me than him, right? So as the more anxious twin, I both need more support and I'm more concerned about him and what people think of him.
Okay, so is that a bit of anxiety projection that you do?
Yeah, exactly. So I think I'm caring for him and really I'm just projecting my anxiety onto him, I guess.
Is that because you're two halves of the same person, so you have to be anxious for the other half of you?
So I think twins polarise each other. If he's worrying about a thing, that gives me the space to not worry about it, and vice versa. So we've just made this podcast called Addicted to Food. A huge amount of our lives over the last 10 years have been spent with me angsting about Zahn's weight and trying to get him to lose weight or control his weight. And he's not
really fat.
Significantly overweight. No, he doesn't have significant overweight, although clinically he does. We don't look particularly different. But it really upsets me, largely because of his health, and largely I angst about what people will think of him. So I try and control that. And that's sort of the basis of the podcast, is me exploring how to control my brother's weight and realizing I can't. It set out as a Chris is going to help Zand lose weight podcast, and it became a how does anyone try and change the behavior of anyone else? And I thought, well, I'm a doctor, so I'm good at that. And it turns out that, like most doctors, I am really actually very unskilled at that. But we interviewed some people who were skilled.
And psychologically, that's a rich picking, I'm going to say. Identical twins, food issues, weight issues, controlling, and you're both doctors. I mean, I'm not a psychologist. I like to dabble in pop psychology, but, you know, we could go for hours with that stuff.
You have a very kind of therapeutic interview style.
Thank you.
You give the impression of being really interested, which is like the basis of almost all therapy. It's really nice talking to you and being like, oh, finally someone cares.
That's because genuinely I am totally interested and very nosy. I am very, very interested.
Yeah, it was so extraordinary making that podcast. I actually thought that it would be impossible to make when we started recording, because there is nothing more annoying than having any family member sort of scrutinize you with a view to making you a better person in anything, but I mean particularly sort of weight and diet and things like that. And we started recording it and it was just miserable. But I mean, it's very difficult because it all comes from a place of love, and the easiest thing is to be the sibling with a problem. It's much nicer to be the person who's being worried about than the person. I would hate it if Chris was having any of the things that he worries about for me. I'd find it enormously difficult. So I know he loves me, and that's why he does it. But it does lead us to get quite annoyed with one another as well. But ultimately, the podcast was very, very funny to make. And it actually brought into the open a conversation that I think has been so impossible to have for so long.
That's so interesting what you just said. I'm stuck on that. I heard the thing about the podcast, but I'm stuck on the fact that it's easier to be the sibling with the problem who's being worried about, rather than being the sibling who's got to be responsible for worrying.
I guess we were making a documentary last year about the COVID crisis, and mostly about Chris's colleagues and Chris's work at University College Hospital in London. And then I got ill and I ended up in A&E at that hospital while we were meant to be filming. And so my illness became wrapped up in that story.
Mm.
And that was all fine. And it sort of fitted in quite appropriately with the sort of the general tone of the thing. And I had to have my heart restarted in A&E, which sort of sounds more dramatic than it was. But it was sort of the program had a moment where my heart flatlined in it, which adds to it definitely, like it's a sort of dramatic bit of telly. And it was dramatic, but it was all done in a very controlled way. And I think there was very little danger of me actually dying. But when I came round from that procedure, I'd had lots of ketamine and, God, I mean, fentanyl, whatever. They just got me up to my eyeballs on drugs. And we'd had a real laugh about, you know, as I was coming around, we'd had a real laugh and it was really nice. And Chris was there to look after me. So I didn't think the footage would be distressing at all. And then watching the final edit of the programme, I found it almost impossible to watch, not because I was ill, but because Chris, when I was anaesthetized, Chris was just bawling. And it was all, even now I have a lump in my throat thinking about it, but he and I thought, God, I would not want to watch Chris have his heart restarted. I wouldn't have been able to manage that at all. And I think he really struggled with it as well.
That's huge. I mean, you say it's a dramatic bit of telly. It's a dramatic bit of life. That's not many people have that sound. I just want to put that out there. Zahn said something so interesting. He said, it's much nicer to be the twin who's worried about, or the sibling that's worried about, rather than the one that has to do the worrying. And he said about the time that he was very poorly and ended up with his heart having to be restarted in the hospital where you were filming, and how he hadn't realised till he saw the footage how much easier it was to be the one who was very ill than the one looking at the one who was very ill. And I wonder what you think about that, Chris, and that episode.
Yeah, I'm the real victim here. I think a lot of families and patients with, you know, people with ill loved ones will sort of acknowledge this, that being the patient is often easier than being the relative. And I see that in my kind of professional work. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, but then like I've definitely had the thought of when I've been worried about Zahn, I've thought, well, I'm going to go and do something and give him something to worry about and then see how he likes it. I'm trying to think of what, like...
That's a constructive way of looking at it.
I've never
really relate to that. I really relate to that. That's a really good... Petty,
and I'd say something like, now look what you made me do. See how it feels. See how you like it. I could do something
taste
like that.
Your own medicine.
That's yeah, yeah, that kind of, yeah, you lace it with some cliche and then storm off. Yeah, Zahn doesn't worry about me very much, but...
maybe he does. I mean,
Of course I do. But I'm... Yeah, no, of course, you know I do, of course I do.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
So tell me what it was like growing up then. There was you two, and what other siblings were there in the family?
So we've got this younger brother, Bratty, or Jonathan, who's now 40 and quite a successful film director. And we all love each other equally, although we have a very different relationship. We don't fight with Jay. I would never have an argument with Jay. And I depend on Jay a lot, but I never worry about Jay. I never call Jay up and tell him he has to change his life or do anything differently in the way that I do with Zahn. Jay doesn't represent me in the way that Zahn does. So growing up was... What can I say about us growing up that isn't...
Was it fun? Was it not fun? Were your parents involved? Were they not involved?
I think my discomfort talking about my childhood is it was so perfect and privileged in sort of every way that it's... I have an unease almost saying that because I think I was so fortunate to have... And, the, you know, they're still around. So fortunate to have the parents I have. So they're very different. Mum is like me. She's quite an intense person. She worries. She still worries. She still nags Zahn about his weight like I do. Dad is horizontal. So mum worked in publishing. She ran a small mergers and acquisitions boutique firm doing scientific publishing work. She's super smart and ambitious, but deeply kind of kind and generous. Dad's very creative. He was an industrial designer. He's become an artist and has a very sort of strange genius about creativity. He has to create constantly. He's constantly sketching and producing and thinking of weird stuff. Mum made childhood safe and educational, and Dad created a huge amount of moment-to-moment fun, blowing stuff up, dyeing our food different colours. Every breakfast was an experiment.
It's so difficult to describe your childhood. What would I say? There was a division of everything between our parents. Our mother brought discipline and a kind of role-modelled diligence and conscientiousness. And our dad, who has all those qualities, but is more... He was not the breadwinner, and he was a bit more anarchic. And he would run little experiments on us and allow us to do whatever we liked. And sometimes that went very poorly.
Most of what we do on our kid show, Operation Ouch, it was all just Dad's ideas. So Dad would go to the butcher's shop. He always called the butcher's shop the dead pet shop. And we thought it was very funny to go in there. And there was this idea that all the animals in there were someone's pet. So we'd buy the heart of someone's dead pet cow. And we'd take the heart home and he would plumb the heart in, and then we'd see if we could figure out how the heart worked, and we'd pump blood everywhere. And Dad didn't know any biology, so he was mucking his way through it, but he could figure out the valves.
I mean, God knows how he knew any of this. I mean, I wouldn't know anything about the heart valve. I finished medical school not knowing that much about the heart valves. Our dad was an industrial designer. I don't know how he knew all this. But anyway, it was an amazingly cheap and funny way of entertaining his children. And then we would cook it and eat it all. We did cook it and eat it.
So no waste.
I mean, as close to zero waste as was fashionable in the 80s, I suppose. And it's funny now, because they're both still alive, we can talk to them. They sort of know which bits of our adult life we think they should get the credit for, which is obviously nonsense. Now I say it out loud, that's totally stupid, but I hope they both feel equally loved.
I do want to rewind a bit, though, to Bratty, the nickname. Where did that come from? And do you and Zand therefore have equally... I'm not going to say unkind, but equally equal nicknames.
Jay's got poor Jay. I mean, he couldn't have called us brats. We were the older grown-up, you know, we're 3 years older. He can't call us a brat. Mm-hmm. And there were two of us. So he was Bratty, and that morphed into... Do you remember the Milk ad where there are two children from Liverpool and they're talking about a football team called Accrington Stanley? Everyone remembers this. I mean, you can't. And so that became Bratlington Stanley. And now, as often as not, we call him Stan. And then he was called Turdsley for a long time. I don't think he'd mind me saying any of this. Maybe he would.
It's a bit sad that we haven't invited him on as well, so he could have his say. I might phone him up after and just get him to send me a little voice note about how he feels about being called Turdsley.
So in terms of my nicknames, you've got Brat, which I guess is fairly self-explanatory. Bratty, Bratsworth, Bratlington. And then that also turns obviously into Bratlington Stanley, which then turned into Stan and Stanley. And which in turn then turned into Stanton. And I think Stanton St. John sometimes. And then you get sort of more common stuff like turd, turdis, shit, shitsworth, little shit. And I guess when I'm feeling really angry, they often call me Mr. Whooptimps, with a sort of emphasis on the whooptimps to really infuriate me.
He's very funny. We interview him about food for this podcast, and he's very good at observing Zand and I, so he sort of does this dissection of the differences between Chris and Zand. And I'm like an anxious bird, sort of pecking and hunting and constant movement, and Zand's more like an excavating machine, eating the same vast volume but just as a sort of continual flow into his mouth. Jason paints these amazing images. He's very funny. I mean, it happens with parents, it happens with younger siblings, doesn't it? You suddenly go, oh my God, this person I've just called bratty and ignored or beaten up his entire life, suddenly he's a really funny, interesting person I'm at university with, and I want to hang out with him, and all his friends are cooler than mine, and he knows nice girls.
There is a moment where your sibling becomes a friend, and that's a kind of extraordinary moment. If you're lucky, and if your parents are lucky, actually, I'm learning with mine, if your parents are lucky, your children become friends, and that's a gift, I think.
Do you think, though, that parents have a role in that? That your parents aren't lucky? If your parents create the right environment, and probably you're somewhat compatible, that they lay the foundations for that friendship?
I don't think it's that simple, because as I've learnt on this podcast, each child, probably with the exception of twins, but maybe still with twins, is born into a different family. You're kind of born into a different tide, a different time, a different home, a different economic setup, a different mood, and so actually the family you're born into is not the same one that your sibling experienced, and that's only one of a multitude of different things that come to bear on the relationship. Character being one, and ambition and temperament and ability and interest, but that seems to me to be really important. Doesn't mean you can't be friends. I'm friends with my sisters and we lived apart, but it's true.
I feel really put down as a scientist that you've just pointed out all the variables that I didn't control for.
I mean,
you idiot,
Mr. Lesniowski from third form would be very proud of me right there. I can imagine as well that for Bratty it was just a massive pain in the bum. You two sort of straight A's and smugly off to medical school. He must have been like, oh great, either the heat's taken off him or everyone's thinking, so what are you going to pull out of the bag then?
Mum's genius is, what's the Marxist, according to need. So not everything is given out equally in terms of love, affection, money, favours, time, but it's always given to the one who needs it most. And we all get that, and we're all the beneficiary of that. Mm. And so there's never any sense that anyone's getting any favourite treatment. And that, I don't think she'd mind me saying any of this. Maybe she will. Mm. We've never been very competitive. It was always really, once we were all grown-ups, I think we kind of realised if Jay does well, we do well, and vice versa.
So why are you as a family quite so, or why are you, the little pecky bird, quite so obsessed with food? Where's that come from in your family?
Oh, that's come from our genes. So I hadn't sort of realised this. We know that obesity is to a very great extent a mixture of genes and environment. And all of the genes that drive weight and weight gain are expressed in your brain. They're not metabolism genes. They're not about how much food you absorb in your gut. They're nothing to do with your bone density. They're not found in fat cells. They're all about your relationship with food. And so on the Addicted to Food podcast, we interviewed Giles Yeo, who's a very well-known geneticist. He's on telly a lot. He tested my genes a few years ago when I made a program with Giles about weight. And I have all of these significant genetic risk factors for obesity. And so anyone who knows me and Zand would go, yes, they have a really peculiar, obsessive relationship with food and lots of people will recognize this in themselves, that I will plan a holiday around a good meal. You know, I will, if Zand and I are we've just been working together filming, and we spend the entire day talking about the evening meal and rummaging through the reviews on the pubs and looking at the menus and downloading the menus and planning, you know, and that's all genetic stuff in the brain that drives your food relationships. Whereas some people, it's just fuel.
There's a whole universe of saying, I'm a foodie, I'm into cooking, you know, there's all that stuff, which I think for us would probably also disguise an interest and an enthusiasm for food that has certainly led me to be overweight. And I think occasionally, maybe not so much anymore, we're trying to be careful, especially after making the podcast and looking into ultra-processed food more. But there would definitely be a thing of both of us going and have a proper sort of blowout, a proper binge, mostly on Chinese food. And we would cook some banquets that were just, you know, an enormous quantity and variety of food. But I still look at them with a certain amount of joy and affection. But what you can do in your 20s and 30s is maybe not wise for a 42-year-old who's overweight with a heart condition.
So part of it is genetic, which is a kind of sciencey answer. And part of it is our mother was an amazing cook and edited the definitive cooking series of the 1980s at Time and Life Books. Mm. And so she was friends with these chefs like Elizabeth David and Richard Olney and these sort of the gurus of amazing cooking and food writing when we were growing up would come to the house and make us dinner. And we'd go and stay with these people in France and they'd cook for us.
Wow.
So most humans do love food and are reasonably obsessed with it. It's why it's on telly the whole time. But I think Zand and I realize as well that we have an addicted relationship with certain kinds of food that we will both eat beyond pleasure, beyond comfort, to the point where we know it's doing us immediate harm, where we'll eat so much we won't be able to sleep, and we know it's doing us long-term harm. In much, I think, with far more vigor than I have ever abused any other drug or substance ever in my life. You know, I've never had that relationship with cigarettes or alcohol or caffeine.
You know, you have certain friends that you know you can get away with being naughty with. You know one that you might go on a big night out with, and you know one that will let you spend lots of money. There's a sort of permission in some relationships. And I wonder whether being a twin, this is the pop psychologist in me, you have this sort of permission in your attitude to food, where you know that the thing you do is you rummage through the pub thing and you know you're going to eat too much. Did it tip over from permissive fun into disorder at any stage?
I mean, it's sort of, yeah. I mean, the question is, you know, how... I never felt like it was out of control. I think there's a problem where we're so surrounded by the type of food that drives addictive eating behaviour, ultra-processed food, that this kind of disordered behaviour is just very normal for so many people. I mean, 1 in 3 UK adults are living with obesity and its consequences. And so this is pretty normal. And what's weirder is I have managed, through no fault of my own, through luck, through blind luck of sort of meeting my wife and having a particular lifestyle over the last decade where I just didn't have the opportunity to eat much. I did a lot of physical stuff, and my wife is really amazing and is very sort of healthy. While Sand has had a very different life, so he's somewhat heavier. And it's nothing to do with his fault. It's just he's lived in a different food environment. But in him, his weight gain genes have been allowed their full expression, whereas I am inside my relatively thin person is a fat person waiting to get out.
What could you do to Zand, like to instantly wind him up? What sort of button could you press with him that would make him wild, sort of in an instant?
We have to get better organised. That's how I'd begin. I really think what we need is to make time to make time. That's like one of my little things. I don't want to be annoying, but can I just say, yeah, something like that.
Often it would be, what's the thing? I know that there's something that, what is the thing that always sets us off?
Should I tell you for time's
sake? It would be like you're interrupting me, you're not listening. Is it that kind of thing?
No, it's like, he would say something like, we need to take time to make time.
Oh my goodness, it drives me mad. Of course, so what he does is he will phone me up and he goes, oh, we need to make a plan. We need to make a plan to make a plan. We need to take the time to make the time. He always does this. And he'll go, I want to sketch it out. I want to sketch it out. I want to block it out. I want to, whatever it is, anything. He wants to make a big map and make a big plan and do it all. And I want to get on with the thing. And it's so annoying. And then when I go, all right, make the plan, he can't do it.
And what would you do to make him feel like you're just feeling?
Nothing. I'm perfect. I would never annoy him in any way. What would I do? I would do the opposite and say, could we please get on with it? Could we just crack on and the problems will emerge and the plan will change anyway, so there's no point in making one. Oh my goodness, you're going to have recorded the complete argument, but just in separate bits.
And what could he do to you?
We have had a lot of therapy or coaching, or we've gone and seen lots of people to stop fighting, because we're a crappy team and we love each other and we should be a good team, but there's no hierarchy, no one's in charge, and we both think we know best, and we're crappy listeners. Can I say crappy?
Yep.
If you have a team where the two people, there are only two people on the team and they both have exactly the same weaknesses and strengths, it's not a very good team. And a lot of his problems lead me to self-loathing as well as annoying irritation with him. You know, if Chris messes something up, my first thought is, why did he mess that up? My second thought is, that's exactly the sort of thing that I would have done.
So we've gone and seen professional therapists who deal with family business relationships and it's all been sort of more or less helpful. We settled on this idea of a chess clock at one point where one is speaking, one gets 5 minutes. When 5 minutes is up, the chess clock switches and the other one gets a go.
And in the end, the therapist, we were off to do some big project and we'd done a lot of sessions and we said, look, come on, we just need something to get us through this next bit. And she said, do you ever have meetings? And we're like, why would we do that? And she said, you might want to try having meetings about your work. And we'd literally, Chris would phone me at 6 a.m. and go, hey, how are you doing? How's Julian, my son? Or like, oh, did you see that film last night or whatever? And then would go, by the way, I'm really worried about the deadline for this project. And everything was a mess. And she said, why don't you separate the personal and the professional. Sounds so obvious, but we had utterly failed to do it.
And so we have just had our producers on this week of Operation Ouch, we've just been filming, had 10 golden rules on the wall, the first of which was that at the first hint of trouble, one of us has to leave and go for a 5-minute walk. And what we think about on that walk is prescribed. Like, you can't just go for a walk angrily. You have to go and think nice things about your brother. So we actually have had
the irony of that being a kids' program is not lost.
A kid came and watched. A friend of mine brought their daughter to watch, and I said, "Did you have a nice day, Isla? What did you learn?" She said, "Well, I learned about the human body, and I learned that brothers argue a lot." We were like, "We hadn't argued once."
It's never going to be easy working with family, but I wouldn't want anyone to think that we don't. A day of work with Chris, I always learn something, spend a lot of the day laughing, but there will be at least 20 minutes of the day where I want to strangle him.
He's the partner I can't get a divorce from. I can't leave. I can't, there's no power. I can't win the argument. So all you can do is scream and shout because there's nothing else to do.
Well, it's so silly because none of our arguments are ever about anything. Anyone listening to it would go, you're both Wallies, make the plan, then start the work.
Oh, can I just have a little moment for the underused word Wally as well? Such a good one. In our family, my dad still calls people chumps. You utter chump. Oh. It's such a great word.
That's another one. Oh, that's brilliant. Chump implies that you're slightly gullible, that you've fallen for a thing, I think.
Yeah. And you can be chumpy, I think, which is cute.
Oh, I'm going to nick that. That's amazing.
Thank you to Chris and Zand. Thank you too for listening.
Am I now starting a row? Is that what I'm doing, Zan?
I didn't know if his quietness was like cross quietness. It felt a bit cross in my headphones.
Is it cross? No, am I just like banging? I'm just banging my usual drum.
I've made progress by listening.
Thank you too to Tanita Tikaram, who let us use this amazing song. Sound design is by Nick Carter at Mixsonics and digital production by Charlotte Griffiths. Next week, Dame Jenny Murray, former Women's Hour and Today programme presenter on Being an Only Child. If you'd like to find out more about the podcast or see some really sweet pictures of Chris and Zand, head to relativelypodcast.com. There's a good tradition of love and hate. Staying by the fireside, there's a good tradition of love and hate. Staying by the fireside, no, the rain may fall. Your father's calling you, you still feel safe inside. Although your ma's too proud, your brother's ignoring you, you still feel safe inside. Oh, was it solo? Was it yesterday? Was it true for you? 'Cause while all the rest had taken time, this didn't do enough for you.
Hi, Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.